I don't know if Mo's in there, but you guys are still on mute. Now we're ready.
Which one is this? Is Crystal, are we going to be looking at Crystal or what? I don't know who it is, I got to be sure they're there. There she is. Okay, good morning, Ms. Jackson.
Good morning.
Okay, this, let's see, this is Administrative Agenda A07-10. And the first matter is General Counsel's Matter 1A.
Thank you, Chairman. General Counsel has brought this before the commissioners. Just to give a little background, about 2 years ago, we had an order writing workshop. We had an outside instructor who came in and put on a workshop for the policy advisors and commissioners and AAs as far as our orders and how we could improve them. And I think we've had significant progress in that regard. So we are just kind of a follow-up to that and have another, because we have new administrative attorneys, a new commissioner, new policy advisors, possibly. And so what we propose, having an order writing workshop, but to be more consistent, because pretty much what I've given you is a compliance order and also an order on a stipulation. I'm sorry, it's an order on a reconsideration and rehearing. As just kind of an example of this was pretty much the recommendation of the instructor, and using bullet points, for example, with the procedural history, and by using the bullet points, it kind of eliminates the tendency to be a little bit too long and repetitious and redundant. And what we decided that we needed to do, and I think we're doing a wonderful job with this, actually, is that we need to spend more time on the analysis of the commission and the findings of the commission, and just give the procedural history just a kind of a basic, this is what happened. Now, obviously, these are short orders, and we're talking about a big order, an IRP or a GRC or a deferred case. There'd have to be a lot more discussion, and we'd have to have some more analysis and some more testimony to support the findings of the commission. But what I wanted to get from you today was a little feedback as to what you think about consistency. I mean, I think it would be important that everyone kind of use the same format, and what kinds of things you'd like to see, if you've thought about this or can think about this, in our order writing workshop, you know, when you're reviewing your orders, because it's the product of the commission that goes out. And as a, you know, and as General Counsel, we review everything, and before it actually leaves the commission. And so I was just kind of wanting to throw this out for any comments you might have for what you'd like us to do. We plan on presenting this workshop and obviously, as a prior English teacher, I tend to, you know, that's not really the point of this, but it's but I like the format here, and I want to know if you do too. The introduction, the summary, and the procedural history, so that you're getting a thumbnail of what's going to go on right away. And then you can go into whatever it is that the issue would be. And obviously, if you're like the last IRP order that had 77 issues or something like that, and I know that Dave had a UIC in order that had lots and lots of issues. So each of those issues would have to be addressed individually the way they have been. But as they're addressed, then you would have the commission discussion findings underneath that. And that's where I think we need to work more. The administrative attorneys are pretty much writing these orders now to make them legally sufficient. And we've done, I think, an incredible job since I came here, because I've been here 10 years in January. And this has been one of my kind of pet projects. But I think the commission discussion findings have improved tremendously. And I think that's part of the reason we've been very successful in our legal proceedings. In fact, the judge in the last one, F.H. Venture, said, I read the commission order, and I agree with general counsel. So I just open it up for any comments you might like to have as to what you'd like us to do.
Thank you, Ms. Cohen. I appreciate you bringing this forward because I've had issue with the fact that there's been inconsistencies on how our orders have been done, and it's largely due to the fact we have a bunch of new people. And I think a refresher course would be beneficial to all of us. And just a reminder, we don't need to cut and paste everything from testimony. We've really, really minimized that, which I appreciate as one who has to read these orders. And I agree with you that the focus needs to be on the discussion and findings. And specifically, I recall from the instructor that you generally write for the loser. Explain why you didn't accept someone's position, and I think that's always something important to keep in mind. So I found the order writing workshop very helpful, and I think it's really improved our orders, and I think it'll be helpful for everybody else to go through a refresher order for the first time. So I appreciate you bringing this forward.
Well, I agree with Commissioner Wagner. I think it's timely. We certainly have enough new folks on staff, and that I think it's probably a good refresher course. And I absolutely agree with the statement that I think we need to spend a lot more time explaining our reasoning and how we got to where we got to. So I think it's a great idea.
Not to belabor it, but I agree with both Commissioner Wagner and Burton Shaw. I struggled a little bit early on with terminology like executive summary, and I think I did that in the last GRC and the IRP too. So I like standardizing. I think the introduction, summary, and procedural history is really important to get out from, but it's not the meat of the order. The meat of the order is, as you say, is the commission findings. And I know when I first came here, I was reading orders that would quote witnesses by name and things like that. And, you know, if I were those witnesses, I wouldn't want my name in an order. So sometimes I don't want to have to sign all these orders and put my name on it, but I think it's better if we do it that way. And I know from an appellate standpoint, when the district court looks at this, they're looking at sufficiency in the record and in the order. And once we establish that, I don't think we need to go much further. I think we really have cut down the trees we've killed too. These orders, my last IRP order, unfortunately, was about 220 pages, but that's probably the longest one we've had in a while. And I think that order writing workshop was really helpful. And I remember that comment that Commissioner Wagner did, and it's really true. When you bulletproof your orders for appellate review, you're writing for the losing side. So he or she who wins, largely everything else is dicta because they've won their case. But you just want to make sure you put the sufficient amount of reasoning in there. So I know this is for feedback only, so I would hope that we would continue through general counsel's auspices, continued training for all of us. You know, I've been doing this for 30 years, but I learn something every day in terms of what I should or shouldn't say. Okay.
Thank you, commissioners. I appreciate it. I'm not exactly sure when we're going to have this workshop, but we're going to, I know everyone's kind of busy now with cases, but we're in the planning stages of how we're going to conduct it.
Okay. 1B is general counsel's recommendation to change administrative process for approving commission policies.
General counsel brought this on basically just to change, because the commission had voted earlier to for feedback only for commission policies, and generally the policies of the commission should probably be approved by the commission. Drafted, enforced by the executive director, but the actual final approval of the policy. So this is to protect the executive director, to make it clear that these policies are the commission's policies. And so this has been brought on to change that particular aspect of the bringing things before the commission from commission feedback to commission approval.
What prompted this? Didn't we discuss this at some administrative agenda meeting before?
It was brought, yes, it's been brought forward, and I've had a concern or two, and we did discuss this, general counsel discussed this as to the background of it, and we do agree that this does provide a kind of some security for the executive director in that this is clear that these are not just the executive director making these policies, commission's making these policies. She's drafting them, enforcing them, and has the authority to do that, but she's doing it with the full authority of the commission.
Okay. And my comment on that, I mean, before, I don't think it really makes a difference whether it's feedback, because the executive director is going to do what we say. But, you know, I think this is good because now the commissioners will need to stand by all of the policies that we approve and actually follow them, too. So we can become instrumental in helping assist in ensuring their enforcement. So I don't really care either way, whether it's approve or feedback, but it puts us on the hook for making sure we follow our own policies.
That's true.
Well, I support this, but I do think the commission, I think it's our obligation to approve it. We really can't escape it. At the end of the day, the commission is really comprised of the three commissioners, and if there's a problem with the policies, we're the ones who have to answer for that. So I think we, as one of the TV ads says, we have to man up and sorry for that, and take responsibility for it. So I think it's good from that perspective, and I do think that it it provides a sense of certainty for the executive director in implementing the policies that the commission develops. I think it's a good move all the way around. You want to say anything? Okay. This is just feedback, right? Discussion?
No, this is...
Are we voting on this?
Voting on it.
Okay, so is there any other discussion before I guess it's appropriate for me to make the motion then to accept General Counsel's recommendation to change the administrative process for approving commission policies from commission feedback to commission approval.
Second.
Okay. Okay, and then 1C, and this is General Counsel's also, it's the process for the 76th legislative session in 2011.
Mr. Noble is handling this one.
Mr. Noble?
Thank you. This is a General Counsel's attempt at memorializing proposed interaction with the legislature leading up to and during the upcoming legislative session. We haven't had a legislative communication policy memorialized in the past, and so this is our attempt to put that in writing so that it's clear for everybody at the commission and anybody else who actually on the outside that reviews this policy knows how it would work. And what I've done is I used Washoe County's legislative communication policy as sort of a template, reviewed that, and it actually was fairly consistent with what we've done in the past, and then I've added things and changed things to make it applicable to the commission. And essentially, it sets up procedure for legislative updates, obtaining commission direction, adopting commission legislative positions, lobbying authority, commissioner participation, bill tracking. And after putting this out, it's come to our attention that technically state agencies are not supposed to lobby, even though we sit at the table right next to lobbyists and do pretty much everything that lobbyists do. So I would propose probably striking the words lobbying where they appear and insert representative or representing, or if commissioners have any other language that they think would be appropriate. So instead of lobbying authority, it would be representative authority. Also, a question has come up with regards to who exactly are the commission personnel, and it was GC's intention that the designated commission personnel could be commissioners or anybody else at the commission. So if the commission determines that a certain commissioner should be the designated commission personnel to spearhead representing the commission's interests at the legislature on a certain bill or a certain subject matter, that would be the case, that commissioners are not excluded from that description. And the last thing that has come up in internal discussions was how to let commissioners know and everybody else know what's going on in between agendas. And I think the best way to do it would be have as important things come up that the designated commission personnel, general counsel, or executive director feel that commissioners should be informed, that there would be an FYI email on the subject matter. The intent, though, would not be for there to be any collaborative discussion with regards to that information. If commissioners or other commission personnel that are receive that email feel that it's necessary to respond to it, they can respond to it, but I just need to be cognizant of the open meeting law when there's those communications. But I felt that that was probably the most appropriate way to disseminate information dealing with the legislature in between agendas when things start to really get moving towards, especially towards the end of the session, and there's so that there's a free flow of information. And if there's any comments, suggestions, changes, like it, don't like it, it's on for an action to hopefully approve in some form. But I open up I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Well, just as a point of clarification, though, if we're going to go back and change the lobbying designation to something else, would it be more appropriate to discuss that now and then have it brought back to us on November the 9th and maybe in a final format?
It's however.
Or do you want us to go? I just think if we go through the whole policy and start picking words right now, we do it transparently, we may be here for quite a while. I mean, generally, I just speaking for myself, I concur that we need to take lobby out of it. We just need to pick a better euphemism, whatever that is, representation or whatever. But we probably need to actually approve a final policy, as opposed to, so maybe we could have a discussion today, generally accepting some of these things and making suggestions, and then just have it brought back to us in its final form. What do you commissioners think about that, or do you have a better way of doing it?
My only concern was the lobbying, using that word. I just think striking that, the rest of it's fine. So I don't even know if we need to have another word for lobbying, just in sub four, just say authority. And then in number five, commissioner participation, just strike lobbying, just say a well-organized effort. I think those are the only two places, Mr. Noble, that lobbying actually occurs. Other than that, I think it's fine.
Well, I've got a couple of things, I guess. On number three, the adopting commission legislative position, I certainly understand why we don't want to be communicating minority positions or opinions to legislators, but I think the way this is written, the person who's put on the spot by the legislature who gets the question, what did the other commissioner say? Are you going to really say to that legislature, I can't tell you? I just think it really puts somebody in a really bad spot, and I think this strict prohibition about communicating that position, but making very clear that that's the minority position and the commission's position is X, is what we should be saying. But I sure would hate to have one of our people put on the spot to tell the legislature, well, I can't tell you that. So I think I'm a little concerned about that language and what could be perceived if we look like we're not trying to be as open and transparent to whoever is asking the question. And with regard to designating the commission personnel, I'm wondering if we shouldn't have a, just as a matter of process, if we can early on identify what bills are going to affect us that we know about now and designate the commission personnel associated with each of those SVs or AVs, each of those bills, and so we can kind of get a jump on it and get people prepared. And then, of course, I think we'll have to have some agendas in the meantime, when other bills crop up, to maybe designate additional commission personnel for the additional things that crop up. But I think if we can make those designations early on based on what we know now, I think that'll be helpful.
And Commissioner, I think as soon as the policy is adopted, it was GC's intention to start putting item on every agenda that deals with the legislature so we can start getting the bill tracking going. And
okay.
Do you have some changes to number three that you'd like to propose?
Let me think. You know, I think maybe the best thing to do is to take that one sentence out. Commission personnel agree not to communicate minority positions or opinions to legislators of the legislature, and put in commission personnel may indicate, when asked, the identity and position of a dissenting commissioner.
So strike out the second sentence and add the words and position after identity in the new second sentence.
Yeah, and we probably with the what the next word is, but with the understanding that they reiterate the majority position.
So you're going to strike the third sentence entirely?
No, I think it's just the second sentence. And then the third sentence would say, commission personnel may indicate, when asked, the identity and position of a dissenting commissioner, with the admonition that they reiterate the majority opinion of the commission.
Would understanding maybe be better?
I think that's a much better word than admonition.
I was trying to avoid that word, but still popped out.
So let's just go to intent for a second here. So this is to make sure that someone's not floating their own agenda at the legislature, and this occurred last legislative session, not with anyone sitting at this table. If we vote on something, that's the commission position. If
correct.
Someone asks, what was the vote? What did you guys decide? So-and-so voted against this. This was the reason why.
Yeah, I mean, I still want somebody to go down there. I'm concerned that somebody ends up getting asked by a legislator, what was the opinion of the dissenting commissioner? And this policy would say that they'd have to say, I can't tell you that.
Right.
And I think that's a bad place to be.
I think it'd be great, actually. I don't know. Yeah, that's top secret. I'd have to kill you. No, so as long as, from past experience, just want to make sure that we communicate the majority opinion, and that
right.
as long as that we're all on the same page with that, this language
yeah.
is.
My contemplation would be the person who gets asked that question say, well, could Mr. Burtonshaw, lost her mind one day and said the X.
Yeah.
Whatever. But the commission, the majority of the commission voted, and this is their position.
Yeah.
So they're not prohibited from telling them what
right.
that information
is.
But reiterating, but the commission's position is X.
Right. I think that's fair enough.
Yeah, I think that's important to bring up, that we have one voice we speak from, the commission position, when we vote on these matters. There's when a legislator asks anybody there that, if it's Ms. Herrera, Ms. Cuneo, whoever it's going to be, where's the commission on this? They need to be able to say, well, there actually was a vote and a discussion, and the commission voted in favor of this. But they also ought to be able to say, but it was a 2-1 vote, and not leave them hamstrung dealing with the legislature, because Commissioner Wagner's right. They want to know. And of course, you can in the final analysis, you could always just say, well, you can call the commissioners and ask them yourself. But I think that change would be right. So do you have? I apologize to all of you, but I just didn't keep up with the changes that were being made. Did you write them down, Mr. Noble? Do you have them?
Yes, and what I'll restate paragraph 3 is, I understand, based on the discussions. So under adopting commission legislative position, it would state, when a legislative issue comes before the commission for direction or action, the majority vote will be the official position of the commission. The commission personnel may indicate, when asked, the identity and position of a dissenting commissioner with the understanding that they reiterate the majority position. Commission personnel shall not present any opinion or position of a single commissioner on any issue if there is any question as to whether the commission as a whole shares the opinion or position.
Does that meet your...
Yes, it does.
Okay. And then the other change would be at paragraph 4, just eliminate lobbying and just have that titled authority. And on the next page, then at paragraph 5, the last sentence, it would be well-organized effort in eliminate lobbying.
The only other thing that I would mention is I think in the past we probably haven't used staff often enough for technical matters before the legislature. And I'd like to see that kind of change because I really think that's where our technical capital is, our intellectual technical capital. And I think that there's an awful lot of times that when we do designated commission personnel for specific items, we have the opportunity, I think, to bring in some of that expertise. And I think that'd be really helpful for some of this fact-finding process the legislature may not have access to.
And I agree, but sometimes they don't want staff. And therein lies the problem. But it's always helpful when they specifically request someone to have someone from staff to be there for technical assistance. But I've had specific requests not to have our staff appear there. So we got to strike that balance. And if they're genuinely looking for information and facts, then it's helpful. But it doesn't always work out that way.
So perhaps we identify what the bills are. We designate the commission personnel. We can probably take that into consideration,
right,
figuring out what's...
And okay. We usually kind of do it as a team effort. And in the past, you know, if we know an issue is coming down, we have Ms. Cuneo and whoever she wants to assign to do some background on it and then provide it. And then everybody's on the same loop and you can kind of have a debate on how the position should work. So we usually try to incorporate staff into it to the degree that we can based on schedule, but sometimes they don't want to hear about facts or technical issues. No offense, Bill.
Yeah, and I agree. And Ms. Herrera is a PIO, is going to be monitoring this anyway, and there's probably going to be times when she really needs a staff person with her if she's put on the spot. So that probably would be a good idea. Subject to what Commissioner Wagner says, sometimes they want somebody else up there to take the heat. Is that it? just a couple more things, and I'll be done. But and I agree with everything that's been said so far. The very first, under legislative updates, after the comma, commission personnel shall communicate at each commission agenda meeting pursuant to a standing agenda item to provide information, obtain direction. And then under 2, the first sentence, directions will be sought from the commission regarding objectives of intent as opposed to specific bill language. And that actually puts us, I realize we have to do it this way, and probably we should do it this way, but since we only have agendas every couple of weeks, I was interested in the flow of information back and forth, and I was thinking, how could we do this, briefing memorandums, but I think Mr. Noble, if I can restate your concept, and if I'm wrong, you correct me, which would just be a communication by email from either the general counsel or the executive director as an FYI, not for deliberation, not for voting, not for anything, but this has occurred in between the agenda meetings. And, of course, it can always be brought up at the next agenda meeting for any finality to that, but it would just be for notification, if nothing else, to the three commissioners as to what's going on. And that would not be violative of the open meeting law. Is that what you're saying, Mr. Noble?
Yes.
Okay. And I think that's a way to do it. And I think in the same vein, though, under 4, the last sentence on that first page, it starts that, however, when the above procedure is unavailable due to the need for immediate decision-making, it is understood that the designated commission personnel shall decide the appropriate position on behalf of the commission. Now, I know we have to do that. You've got to empower people to do it, but maybe I would just suggest, and I'm open to any kind of language here, that we have a comma there and say something like subject to notification or verification, or I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, I don't know that I want a person being put on the spot. This kind of goes in with staff personnel being there and being put on the spot and say, I need to know what the position of the commission is, and that person having to state, it looks like the commission position without us ever having said anything about it. And I guess all I'm saying is that I would at least like to know that. If that's had to happen, if I just got an email saying this is what we've done, and maybe it's the same thing we're talking about here at number 1, because I may or may not agree with that, and I might need to contact that legislator myself and say, just so you know, I know that this person had to answer that question, that did the best they could, but I don't really agree with that. So, I mean, I guess what I'd be saying is just put in there maybe subject to notification or something, or some other language.
And Chairman, I think if you look at the last sentence of that provision, it says commission personnel shall report such actions to the executive director and or general counsel as soon as practicable. And to the commission at the next available commission agenda meeting. So the formal process would be, say I was at the legislature, got asked, is this language appropriate? To the best of my knowledge, knowing what the commission's position is on that general issue, I have to make a call right then. I say what I think is the commission's position. I go back and let general counsel and or the executive director know. They would most likely, I would assume, based on our discussion today, an FYI email would go out to the commissioners saying this is what happened, and we'd proceed accordingly.
Okay, and I'm completely satisfied with that answer. I think I'm just really doing this for the record so that we would have had this discussion as opposed to not bringing it up and wondering what to do, but it looks like it's covered, and there's, I can't remember where it is right now, but there's something in here along the lines of if one of us has discussions with a legislator, we should let general counsel and executive director know so that we're all on the same page. Here we are. It's under 5. Commissioners are requested to notify executive director on administrative matters or GC on policymaker matters of contacts with legislators. So I think what this, it seems that what we're doing here, and I'm really glad to see this, you know, I know Ms. Commissioner Wagner is after her experiences in the legislature more than any of us, but it's a two-way communication between commissioners and sort of the point of the spear of the people that are going to be working there, and I think that's good. So I don't really have any more comments. Do you? So, have we gone through all the changes so that we're in a position to make a motion to accept this as drafted? Or modified?
As modified.
As modified. Do I need to go through everything, Ms. Cohen, or just call it as modified?
No, I think it should be clear from the discussion. Good. And Dave read, I mean, Mr. Noble read number 3.
All right, so I guess it would be to accept general counsel's proposed process for the 76th legislative session in 2011 as modified.
Second. Concur.
Okay. The next one is general counsel's also.
Thank you, Chairman. I brought this before the commission because, you know, this is a work in progress with our administrative agendas. And this is a recommended process for general counsel to present administrative matters to the commission. And it more or less echoes the executive director's the process that is utilized for the executive director also, with the exception of statutory authority, because there really isn't any specific statutory authority for general counsel's communications with the commission, because the commission is a client on the policy side. But this is an effort to more or less communicate with the commissioners, let them know what general counsel's doing, getting feedback, you know, in an open forum as to what you may think or want to hear from us or direct us on when it comes to administrative things, and also just to keep you apprised as to what we are doing, because we work constantly to try to improve orders, work on compliance orders. We have an AA manual that we constantly, things like that. So it would kind of encompass that. So the process that we recommend is that there's a commission's advisory authority, which would be a vote, which means that we would bring, which we are doing currently, we bring administrative matters before the commission for a vote, and these matters could include proposed changes to commission policy, as well as the implementation of administrative processes such as that for the legislative session, which is what we've just done. So I'm just asking you to more or less formalize and vote on accepting this process that we've kind of been using. Commissioners' feedback would be, we would bring matters before the commission for your feedback to us. And this could be our proposed workshop on commission orders or other matters in which you have a direct interest in letting us know what you'd like, you know, as far as the commission's more or less matters that we deal with on a daily basis. An update would be we'd bring administrative matters before you to provide you with information, which could be the continuing modifications and updates to the administrative attorney handbook, modifications to commission notices, because we change that a lot. And when we make these changes and when we change orders and things like that, we can bring that to you and let you know we've done that. Because we every time something happens, for example, we have a court decision, and the court decision prompts us to change something pursuant to the problems that we encountered through our arguments. And so that would enable us to come and tell you what we're doing when that happens. And then finally, it would just be things that we just deal with on a day-to-day basis where we'd have no commissioner involvement, which would be individual consultation, for example, with commissioners on their cases, which obviously we wouldn't discuss, you know, in an open meeting. Advice we give to administrative attorneys, advice that we give to the executive director, to the assistant commission secretary, about continuing personnel and daily matters. So I've basically just been bringing you this to more or less formalize these processes, and it will make us more active to actually let you know what we're doing and also for you to let us know what you would like us to do.
Just for clarification, you're actually contemplating, I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't want another administrative agenda. So this would be like a part of the existing administrative
agenda. Oh, definitely. Just like today.
Like today.
Today is the perfect example because we brought these matters before you for a vote.
Right.
And so we're going to be trying to get more active about bringing things at these administrative agendas.
Okay. Questions or comments, anyone? Okay. Then, let's see. Then I move that we accept General Counsel's recommended process for presenting administrative matters to the Commission.
Second.
Okay. Ms. Jackson, 2A.
Thank you, Chairman. As you may recall, the Legislative Counsel Bureau began an audit of the Commission back in August of last year, and I am happy to report that that audit has been completed. The audit period was for fiscal year 2009. It also included some activities through February of this year. NRS 218.823 provides that the results of the audit shall not be disclosed until the report is presented to the Audit Subcommittee of the Legislative Commission, at which time it becomes a public document. The Audit Subcommittee did approve the audit report on September 29th, and a copy of that report was provided in your briefing materials for this item. The audit found that the Commission substantially complied with state laws, regulations, policies, and procedures with respect to its financial, administrative, and information technology activities. The audit report also contained 7 recommendations for the Commission to approve our financial, administrative, and information technology controls. The 7 recommendations are to revise our procedures to ensure reasonable and timely collection efforts are taken on outstanding fines, and all accounts receivables are properly reported to the state controller when required. We are required to revise procedures to ensure prompt enforcement actions over delinquent assessment and fee reports, update revenue procedures to ensure adequate segregation of duties and restricted access to revenue received in the Las Vegas office, improve our expenditure controls by developing procedures to adequately monitor cell phone use and ensure employee travel reimbursements are accurate. Ensure that staff follows inventory procedures to physically inspect commission vehicles. Set passwords to be a minimum of 8 characters and to change at least every 90 days. Conduct periodic security awareness training and require employees to sign a security awareness agreement after receiving the training. We have accepted all of the recommendations, and we have taken immediate action to revise and implement procedures to implement each of those recommendations. The Commission is also required by law to submit a plan of corrective action to the Director of the Department of Administration no later than December 29th of this year. A copy of that letter is included in your briefing materials. and I would appreciate any feedback that you may have before that letter is submitted. Additionally, by May 29th, 2011, the Commission must provide the Division of Internal Audits a status report, and by June 29th, 2011, the Director of the Department of Information Administration will provide the same to the Legislative Auditor. Lastly, included in your briefing materials for this item is a draft report of administrative fines, which includes the name of the regulated utility, the fine amount, any amount paid, the date of the payment, the docket number, and the date the outstanding fines are submitted to the Comptroller's Office for collection. I thought this report might be helpful in communicating to you money that is owed to the Commission and all of our collection efforts. That concludes my presentation, and I would appreciate any feedback or suggestions you have on this item. Thank you.
Anything? Well, there's real no feedback, except I appreciate the timely manner in which you responded to this, Ms. Jackson, and the seven recommendations. I think your letter covers them all. And I think it's important to note that substantially the agency was in compliance, but these are improvement suggestions, and I think you've done a really good job in responding in action as well as in notification through this letter. That's really all I've got. Okay, the next matter is 2B.
Pursuant to NRS 704.309, the Commission shall levy and collect an annual assessment from each railroad, subject to the jurisdiction of the Commission that transports cargo into, out of, or through the state to support the activities of the Commission relating to our railroad safety program. The two railroads are Union Pacific Railroad and BNSF Railway Company. This assessment must be equal to the costs incurred by the Commission that are not offset by other fees paid pursuant to law, and must not be more than 1 cent per ton of cargo transported by the railroads into, out of, or through the state during the immediately preceding calendar year. As a result, in August of this year, the rail annual assessment rate for fiscal year 2011 was set at .00951 per ton. This assessment is due to the Commission before November 1st. I've included a copy of the assessment letter that was mailed, I believe, on August 25th, along with the calculations that were used for setting the assessment amount. Are there any questions?
Nothing, no. All right, so item 2C.
Item 2C, I place this matter on the agenda just to advise you that the Nevada Renewable Energy and Energy Efficiency Authority did make a request for assistance pursuant to NRS 701.330 for a small business impact statement for proposed regulations regarding evaluation of energy consumption information concerning homes listed for sale. I referred the matter to regulatory operations staff, and staff provided the requested small business impact report, and you have been provided a copy of that in your briefing materials.
Well, I know how much staff really enjoys doing these, so kudos to Ms. Pecunio.
Yeah, a while back in one of our agendas, we actually delegated the authority to respond to these requests to the executive director. Has this pretty much been the only thing we've had on our radar, Ms. Jackson, in the recent memory?
Yes, Chairman.
Okay. All right. And all right. I guess it's 1D.
Actually, I think it's
2D. I'm sorry, 2D. Excuse me. Yeah, 2D.
Thought it might be time to provide you all with an update regarding the Las Vegas office and the upcoming move. As you may recall, the last time I provided an update at an agenda meeting was in August. So quite some time has passed, and quite a lot has happened. Last Wednesday, we did a walkthrough of the new office in order to create a punch list of items that were either still outstanding or items that required repair. We are currently working with the contractor, and they are diligently working on these items, and we expect that those will be completed within the next week or two. We were successful in getting the fiber, and our IT staff advised me this morning that it is done, it is in, we are ready. So good news, we will not be doing the rooftop antenna for our communications, and this will also provide the ability to have hearings simultaneously in both hearing room A and B. So hopefully that will help with resolving some of our calendaring issues. Additionally, I've been advised that the Department of Information Technology is loaning us a router so that we can have our IT equipment installed and tested prior to our move. The new video conferencing equipment for Hearing Room A is expected to be installed at the new location the week of November 8th. We will, the electronic hearing room monitor will also be mounted next week at the new location. In Hearing Room A, we are having witness tables built to match the dais. We were able to have these built for the same price as purchasing stock tables, so we opted to have these tables built in a U-shape, very similar to what we currently have in Hearing Room A now. In Hearing Room B, we will have a temporary setup that uses existing furniture. We are hopeful that once we get in there and all parties use the room, we can better dial in the needs of that room and hopefully come up with a configuration that will work for all of us. So please know that that is just a temporary setup until we can get in there and really see what the needs are and how that room will be utilized. We now have a large conference room for staff, and we also have a large conference room for policy. We also, with respect to security issues, we have installed 7 keypad locks at the new Las Vegas office. In conjunction with a visitor policy, which is also included in the policy manual today, we are hopeful to have limited access to the non-public areas of our new location. There will be a keypad lock on the door from the lobby into reception. There are keypad locks in both of the hearing rooms that enter into the non-public workspace areas of employees. There are 2 doors in the main corridor that enter into our internal hallways. Those will have keypad locks. The IT computer room, I believe, will have a keypad lock or a key lock. We're in the process of having that installed now. And we also have added a keypad lock to staff's confidential file room for all of their records. We also have a consumer interview room, which is off of the lobby. It has a glass door and a glass window, so we are hopeful that consumers will be able to meet with our compliance investigators in that room, again, to limit the public access into the private workspace. We are also hopeful that that room can be utilized as a settlement conference room in the event you break out into settlement discussions. That room would be easily accessible, again, to the general public. We also have upgraded the 2 Xerox machines. They include all the capabilities they originally had, plus bait stamping capability, scanning, and colored printing. The machine should be delivered next week and will be hooked up the following week, and we hope to have them operational before we move in. We will have key personnel trained, and I believe IT staff is working on the scanning protocols. One will be located on the commission policy side, and the other one will be located on the staff side in the copier room near Karina's office. We also have several office tours scheduled for employees to see their offices. We're hopeful to get everybody over there before the actual move occurs. Employees are required to provide their office layout plans by November 5th, so the movers know where to place their furniture. Boxes and carts will be delivered on November 3rd, and labels will be handed out next week, along with a move orientation that will cover the packing instructions. Information is also located on the T drive, So if there's something that you need access to, you should be able to reference it from the T drive. I think as you hopefully know by now, the actual move will take place November 15th and 16th. The phones will be switched over beginning the afternoon of the 16th, and we do expect a disruption in service during that switchover. Service to the new office is anticipated by noon on the following day, November 17th. We will not have any proceedings the week of the 15th, but we will be open for business, and we expect to be fully operational at the new location by November 22nd. We also have 32 reserved covered parking places, and we are in the process right now of having the eaves labeled reserved PUCN, and we're hopeful to get the logo that is on our monument sign added to that as well. We expect to have our illuminated monument sign installed by November the 9th, and we are also anticipating our door logo to be completed by November the 19th. I could probably go on and on about all of the things with the Las Vegas office, but I'll stop there. I know your time's valuable, and I'll entertain any questions at this time. Thank you.
Well, no questions, but wow. I actually went on a visit the beginning of October, and the level of resources that you and Ms. Skye have directed towards this effort is just amazing. And the level of detail, the minutiae, the wow, it's just been amazing. All the little things that are necessary to make this thing work, and you guys have been right on top of it. And I can't even imagine the amount of resources it's taken away that you have invested in this. And the Las Vegas office really appreciates it.
Yeah, you know, I a long time ago, before most of you were born, I had a big project, $15 million expansion, and I had to do most of this, what they're talking about, with a lot of change orders, and it almost broke me. I can assure you I don't have the stamina to do it now. Just the sheer volume of logistics with all the balls in the air that you've got to have, and it, you know, it's been a team concept, and everybody has pitched in at every level, but particularly Ms. Jackson and Ms. Skye and Mr. Dennis and Mr. DeMario, and I hate to start naming names because you're going to leave people out, but those four people really come to mind because that's the four that I see really in terms of a lot of the emails and the information that goes back and forth. But I think it's important to remember that these people all have jobs. They still have responsibilities, and very important responsibilities. They've done all of their jobs exceedingly well, at the same time devoting time and effort to keeping this project moving along. And you know, like Commissioner Burtenshaw and Commissioner Wagner, to go out there and see that, I think the term is grayscale, but you go out there and you see just a big empty shell, gray shell, and then to see what it looked like when I was there 2 days ago when Ms. Skye gave me a tour, it's pretty staggering, the work that's gone into that. And it could not have happened but for the team effort of this commission in both of its offices. It could not have happened but for the direction of Ms. Jackson and the hard work of Ms. Skye and the others that were involved. So I thank you for that. Okay, so the next matter is 2E.
Thank you, Chairman. Pursuant to NRS 703.130 sub 5, the Executive Director, with the approval of the Commission, shall designate an Assistant Secretary. As you may recall, the position was vacated last June, and Ms. Potter has served in an acting capacity since that time. I have provided you a copy of the class specification so that you are familiar with the minimum qualifications and the duties of the position. I have also provided you with a copy of Ms. Potter's resume. Given her tenure with the Commission and her experience with both the Policy Support Division as well as Business Process Services, I believe Ms. Potter is an excellent choice for this position, and with your approval today, I would like to recommend the designation. And she is here today, and after her acting period, she has assured me she is still interested in the designation.
I don't know. This is kind of a tough one for me. you know, Ms. Potter gets things done, communicates well, always willing to help me out when I come down with stupid questions. So, no, I'm joking. I think she's a great choice, and I enjoy working with her. And it's too bad you guys don't get to spend more time up north. She's a great person. So, congratulations. I wholeheartedly support this, and I guess move from acting to real, whatever that means.
I am constantly amazed at the deep bench of commission talent we have, and Ms. Potter is certainly on that bench. And we're glad to welcome her to the full-time position, and she's going to do great. And thank you for taking it.
Well, you know, I had supported Ms. Brewer for this, so I don't know who Ms. Potter is, but I'm just kidding. She's done a wonderful job, and she, you know, it's a real quantum leap when someone takes a position on an interim basis. And I made the joke whenever that happened that she had the job and the responsibility but not the economic remuneration that went with it. So now this will flow with that, and she has done a wonderful job, and I have the utmost confidence in her. I know that she will in the future. So kudos and congratulations. Do we need to vote on this one?
You do, please.
We do. Okay. Then with pleasure, I move that we accept the Executive Director's designation of Breanne Potter as the Assistant Commission Secretary.
Second.
Concur. 2F.
Okay, 2F. For your review and vote today is a manual of internal administrative policies. The manual includes policies that were previously issued. It also includes policies that were never issued but have been used, and also includes some new policies. The idea here is to have one comprehensive manual for employees to use, basically in lieu of issuing and tracking individual policies. There are a couple of areas that I've highlighted in your manual for discussion purposes that have been brought to my attention by individual commissioners. They are on pages 12 and 32. On page 5, I would like to suggest a change. Specifically with respect to your vote earlier today on changing policies to advisory vote from feedback. On page 5, if you'll turn there, the paragraph, the purpose paragraph, the last sentence should be changed to read, "Once issued, policies will remain in effect until superseded or amended by the commission."
I'm sorry, would you say, where is that again, Ms. Jackson?
Under purpose, the last sentence that starts with "once issued," the sentence should read, "Once issued, policies will remain in effect until superseded or amended by the commission." And as you will note on that page, I did change under procedure A1 to commissioner vote before issued, revised, or suspended. And I also, under sub 2, added in that the policies are issued under the signature of the commission, which essentially would be the vote. I'm not asking that you each sign these, but it would just be your vote. With those changes, Chairman, I can walk through each policy if you'd like, or we can go directly to the areas that are highlighted on page 12 and 32 and discuss those, or however you'd like to proceed.
Well, you know, first of all, it might be helpful, and this is just for my benefit, and I apologize, but I actually had to go back to the old manual and sort of figure out which ones were new and which ones had been changed. So, and I know we're doing this as a work in progress. So just as a suggestion, respectfully, if in the next time, maybe if they could be like a little stamp or something, say this is a new policy, that would help, at least it would help me in terms of sort of going through these. I apologize to my other two commissioners, but I actually would sort of just maybe like to go through them individually, since we are going to have to vote on these things. It doesn't have to be a long presentation. I don't really have questions on just maybe one or two. But is that okay with the other commissioners if we do that? And maybe we can just vote on them individually like this. I have no questions on the policy 1.1 with your modification.
I have one suggested change. Sorry. I think to make 1 and 2 kind of flow together on page 5, I'm wondering if we could change the policies. The way it reads now, kind of, they're almost operating independently. So I'm thinking that maybe we should change policies will be reviewed for consistency with the commission vote by general counsel's office and issued under the signature of the commission.
Under A2?
Yes.
Can you say that again?
You bet. Policies will be reviewed for consistency with the commission's vote by general counsel's office and then issued under the signature of the commission. So that 1 and 2 work dependently on each other.
Any other changes or comments on 1.1? Okay, then I move we accept policy 1.1 as amended by these comments.
Second.
Concur.
Okay, and then policy 1.2. I actually have no comments or suggestions on 1.2, commissioners.
None.
Okay, then I move we accept policy 1.2.
Second.
Concur.
Policy 1.3, I actually have no questions or comments, commissioners. Okay, well, I move we accept policy 1.3.
Second.
Concur.
And policy 1.4, energy efficiency. I do have questions and comments, but I will defer to the other commissioners first if you have any. Do you have any?
Okay.
I guess this comes down to, and I know the genesis of this policy, but I guess my question really is, do we want to actually, as an agency, have a real energy efficiency policy? It seems, when I read this, and I want to tell you that I mean no disrespect to anyone, but if we have an energy efficiency policy, perhaps it needs to be one that goes to the extent of true conservation, which would lend toward actually having no small appliances in offices. It seems to me counterintuitive to have a policy that says energy efficiency, and then the first thing we have is a specific designation for space heaters, which draw the most energy of anything you can possibly imagine. Notwithstanding practical need, and I'm not getting into that, I'm just saying it is what it is. And it's also been somewhat vague with regard to other small appliances. And, you know, I have been to Carson City a few times, and I have walked around, and I've worked down here, and there's just a whole panoply of tea warmers and small refrigerators, and some offices even have microwaves. And I guess my suggestion is that if we really want an energy efficiency policy, maybe we need to not approve this and let it go back to the executive director. We have energy efficiency and conservation experts here, and maybe we need to take a holistic, real look, you know, at our energy efficiency policy that we as an agency can be proud of. I mean, we've gone to the time and the effort to go into a LEED certified building. We're sort of the energy efficiency experts ostensibly, and we lead the way. So maybe we should walk the walk. That's just a suggestion. Another suggestion would be simply to change the name of this policy from energy efficiency to something else. If in fact we're going to allow small appliances, then we need to be consistent about that. So I guess I've got a couple of suggestions. I don't really have, as we used to say, a dog in this hunt. I don't have a vested interest one way or the other. I'm comfortable with having no small appliances and having centralized break rooms. You know, we've been raising money for a refrigerator north and south. Perhaps we need to think about establishing break rooms in the north. We certainly have the room. I've been up there enough to know there's some empty offices. And rather than consolidating this into a variety we actually do have some empty offices up there and some space up there that we could designate. And if that was our directive, we would do that. Notwithstanding that, you know, I'm aware that, you know, different sections have consolidated areas, so there's a multiplicity of areas up north that are actually where these appliances are consolidated. I don't even know how many they are. Maybe Ms. Jackson does, but I wouldn't be surprised if there were four or five of them up there. So, you know, I mean, from an energy efficiency standpoint, how energy efficient is that? Perhaps what we could do is just take the money we've raised and split it in half and have one or two break rooms up north. There's twice as many people there, and a break room down here, and just not have any appliances in any office. I mean, that truly would be more energy efficient if that's what we're doing. And if we're not doing that, then let's be consistent about it. If we're going to allow appliances, then let's say that. Because it although other than the specification of space heaters, it really doesn't say that other appliances are not allowed. In fact, if you read under D, the inference is appliances are allowed, but for B2. So I don't really have a strong suggestion here. I just want us to talk about it and sort of come to some consensus that's fair and consistent. So,
quite frankly, regardless of what it's called, I think it's kind of milquetoast. It's worked really well in the north, and most of it is conservation efforts. But none of the stuff that's required here or recommended is particularly difficult to comply with. That's why it seems kind of strange to even be discussing it. We don't have a break room in the north. We've consolidated because our offices are more clustered into suites, so that works well. Like you said, we have twice as many employees. We've all consolidated. I remember when we first implemented this, they went through and got rid of all the inefficient space heaters. Let me remind you how crappy the building is that we're in, which was only reminded me more getting to see the movie. The fact that you get to move into a LEED building, which is spectacular and it's awesome, what we deal with up in the north with leaking roofs and mold and weird things that go on there, I don't see how this is very difficult to comply with. If we change the name, energy efficiency and conservation, I mean, that seems irrelevant to me. I think if you're going into a LEED building, you need to have some kind of standard. You know, if it were me, I'd probably put 20 more items on here. So I think it's fine as it is. I don't really see the issue.
Well, I do see the issue, and I think it's short-sighted to say because we're going into a LEED building that there's energy efficiency of policy will apply to a certain segment as opposed to those who are in an old building that there's no energy efficiency
and
policy.
That's not what I was suggesting. Not at all what I stated. But go ahead.
You have other comments?
Ms. Jackson, I guess I'm kind of curious about the concept of a break room for the folks in the north. The with Commissioner Wagner, the building up there is let's just say that if we have the opportunity to move into another building in 2013, I think we need to pursue that as much as possible. But I guess one of the things that have always bothered me about that building is the suites. Everybody is sort of segregated into all these different little pods. And so there's not an awful lot of free flow of communication, I think. People have to, you know, there's just not this kind of movement. We're down this really dark hallway. And I was wondering if there's a possibility that a break room might be a really kind of a nice place for people to come and kind of have an interaction they probably don't have during the workday. But I think that's limited by whether or not we actually have space for one. But I was kind of curious about that concept, if that might actually be a good thing for the Northern Nevada office, for, you know, just kind of more interaction among everybody that is in these isolated little pods throughout the day.
Thank you, Commissioner, and I appreciate that feedback. If I could kind of go back to 2006 when the energy efficiency policy was developed, keep in mind that almost every employee had a small appliance of some sort, whether it was a refrigerator, a microwave, a toaster, a blender, a space heater. And we went through the offices and essentially swept, had employees upgrade refrigerators, because as you know, what typically happens is we bring in our old refrigerator from home for our office, and those use the most energy. So we went through, we had folks consolidate by division, which, you know, you're correct, there is kind of a common area within each of the divisions. that could accommodate a little break room area, if you will. Many employees reduced lighting. We went through the space heaters. We got rid of all the space heaters that didn't comply with the 1,500 wattage, which it's my understanding that is an efficient energy space heater. And those are to be unplugged, and they are only to be utilized in the event that, you know, the heat is not working, which up here in the north, that happens a lot. And in fact, yesterday, I had a slew of repairmen up on the roof repairing leaks and repairing basic heating outages that were out throughout, you know, the building. So I really think we do need to have those space heaters available in the event they are needed. With respect to empty office space, quite frankly, I would need to tour the building and really take a look at what we have. The vacant offices that come to mind right now are within the commission area, which, as you know, we just put a keypad lock on, and not all employees have access to that area. The other thing is that we don't have running water or a sink or anything of that nature. So, you know, at a minimum, we might be able to set up some tables, you know, and perhaps a little refrigerator, but we really don't have the accommodations of an actual break room. So, you know, I'd be happy to go through and take a tour, see what's empty, see what we have, if that's the desire of the commission to have a break room up in the north.
Let me ask you, because I can't visualize it in my mind right now, but when we first moved into the building, there was like a little business there where people had, you could come in and buy stuff to eat. It's yeah. Wisconsin.
That's the yeah. That's now been converted to the Assistant Commission Secretary's office.
Okay. Sorry. That's why I can't visualize it anymore. Okay.
that was actually run, I believe, by the Blind Services. And, you know, in some state offices, they did have a little snack bar type. And then Blind Services, I think, ended up taking those out. And then it was actually converted as a maintenance room for our maintenance guy, who is here on site dealing with maintenance issues on a daily basis. And then later, we converted that space into an office.
I don't know if it's something you may want to think about pursuing or not. In my mind, I thought it was pretty, obviously if you don't have the space, it's, you know, it'd be logical about it, but.
If I could defer to Ms. Scott, do you happen to know if we have any office space other than in the commission, the secured commission area?
There's one space that was vacated by an engineer that's on the second floor that, we may be able to clear out. Right now we've been using it as an overflow for storage because we can't store items down in that commission area. So it's a possibility. It would be better than having nothing. But again, there's no water. The problem is, too, the power source. As you know, we can't have heating and microwave going on at the same time or we end up blowing the circuit panels.
And just to, from one of the people in the north, I don't have an objection to a break room. I'm not sure how much it'll be utilized. I go into engineering to get baked goods from Janelle, and they're awesome, always. But I'm always uncomfortable walking in when they might be meeting, and it's not unusual for them to scream out commissioner, which is not only startling, but it's like, I wonder who they're talking about. So, I'm not sure that we have a good setup to have a break room, and I don't know if people would actually use it, just because of that segregation with staff and policy. Because I know it's rare that I will go upstairs unless it's Janelle's banana nut bread. So that night, if we did consider something like that, I think it needs to be in a neutral area. I know that it was sensitive in what we refer to as the bat cave, the commission area right now. I couldn't tell who was outside of my door and oftentimes it was members of staff, and which I don't have a problem with it, but if I'm having a conversation with a policy advisor, that made me really uncomfortable. So just having some sensitivity to that, I just don't know of our offices, and maybe it's just something that we look to do in the future. I don't know, but plus I would be curious to see if employees would even engage in it. I think, I don't know if they would utilize it or not, so.
I think generally employees would like to have a centralized break area. The space that I spoke of is clearly deep within staff side, and there may be, it may create the problems that you were just describing.
You know, over in the new building here in Las Vegas, there's one break room, and it's the same problems that you're talking about. If that, and I'm hoping there won't be a problem there, but the it'll be one break room shared by policy and by staff. So, I know what Commissioner Wagner's saying, because from time to time before Miss Scott put a coffee pot up front, I'd go back in the back to get a cup of coffee, and you always had that little bit of trepidation as you went through the door as far as hearing a phone conversation and walking by Ms. Cordova's office and others. But I guess what I'm saying is that we're all ethical people and we're all doing the right thing, I think. And I certainly think we're all motivated to do the right thing. And so, you know, it's just a matter of us understanding that and dealing with it. And I also think that I really mean this as an olive branch here, because I really think everybody's after the same thing here. It's just a matter of how we skin the cat. You know, it's most of us spend more hours here than we do at home. So certainly that's an old drafty building up north, and it gets cold. And I see the very practical need to have space heaters up there. I'm not trying to be Simon Legree here and remove that. But there are other practical needs too. And, you know, I think that allowing people to have some creature comforts in their office, frankly, most of the time that I'm here, I eat my lunch at my desk with one of those Lean Cuisine meals that I microwave here. And I think a lot of us do that, we spend a lot of time here, and we should make it as comfortable as we possibly can within the limits that we've got. And certainly a big limitation that we've got, and Mr. Dennis isn't in here right now, but Mr. Dennis and Mr. DiMario do talk to me about the power load, and particularly as it affects video conferencing and blowing circuits and things. So we have to be aware of that. So I'm amenable to almost anything to get where we need to be, which is a fair, consistent policy for people that's clear, that everybody understands. And maybe what I would suggest is that we table this, or just let the executive director maybe do a little survey up north and see if there really is an interest in having a break room. Maybe take some time and look around and see what's available up there, or if there's maybe even two places. I understand that North and South have raised pretty close to the same amount of money. So instead of, which was a wonderful effort, I think largely spearheaded by Ms. Gaw, and I really appreciate that, but maybe we could just split the proceeds and allow that proceeds up north to be used up there, and those down here, and we just do the best we can, whatever we can afford. And those are just suggestions I've got. But I guess the biggest thing I'm suggesting is that maybe we just table this matter and let it be brought back to us after based on this discussion and feedback, and maybe some better insight and better solutions by Ms. Jackson. And you know, we've got an agenda on the 9th, and we've got one December the 8th, and just my thought. Anyone?
No, I'm just too thick-headed, and I just don't understand the problem. So I don't see the problem with these policies as it stands. They just seem common sense. But
one of the questions that I've been asked by a lot of our Las Vegas employees is about their refrigerator, as to whether they can have it over at the new location, and that we're nearing a point in time where a decision needs to be made whether they need to take it home or whether it can be relocated to the new office. the fundraiser that the chairman spoke about, the monies that were donated were specifically for an Energy Star refrigerator for the Las Vegas office. If we were to change gears, I would return all the monies to those who made those donations and start from ground zero.
I'm confused. I thought the whole point of having the break room and having a central refrigerator is so that we didn't have as many appliances.
That was my understanding as we went into this.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was confused about. I thought one refrigerator, and that's what we raised the money for, so you all could share it in the break room.
Okay, let me, you know, I was trying to avoid this, but let me just get right into it. This issue actually came up because of that. Because the executive director puts out a monthly communication to all the employees, and by the way, I mean, I have some suggestions about that. Perhaps there really should be a commissioner's corner or something in there, because right now it's just a communication one way from the executive director in one direction to all the other employees of this agency. There's really nothing in there from the commissioners who appoint the executive director with regard to any communication. It's just simply from the executive director one way. I really think that's short-sighted. To use the same word. I think that needs to be looked at. In that publication, there was an edict put out interpreting policy, and I think it was 1.6 or 6.1 in the old format, it's now 1.4, is forbidding individual refrigerators from going into those offices. Now, when you read this, it doesn't say that. And to extrapolate and interpret the language of consolidation of individual office appliances to a central area to the point where it says thou shalt not have a refrigerator is something of a reach. And when it's done pretty much ex parte without even commissioner's knowledge or input and just sent out to all employees, which was done, it caused a lot of confusion. It caused some consternation. Most people down here in Las Vegas use those little refrigerators to put their meals in. They use it to put water in, because we don't drink the water out of the water fountain, even if there is one in this new building down here in Las Vegas. That's one of the great advantages you have in Reno and in the north, is you have good, clear water. I have reverse osmosis in my house. Most of us drink bottled water down here. So we use it for other purposes like that. That was the genesis of this problem. Was this interpretation of this policy, which is not worded that way, and the fact the inference is opposite, and the dissemination of that information agency wide, that's what caused the problem in a nutshell. And all I'm trying to say is, let's be consistent, let's be fair, we're one agency, so let's try to have a policy which is fair and consistent for everybody.
Okay, so that's the part I didn't understand. I didn't see the publication, but I thought the whole reason for doing the fundraiser for the refrigerator was so that you'd all have one refrigerator to share. And so now I'm confused why we would have a bunch of little refrigerators and then one big one. And if you don't want the big one, give the money back and keep your little refrigerators and upgrade them to Energy Star ones. I mean, it seems like a one or the other. I didn't know it was going to be a new refrigerator and a bunch of little refrigerators. And quite frankly, I don't care, but we raise money for one refrigerator, not, you know, it needs to just be one way or the other.
Well, and again, the fundraiser did not start with the commissioners. The fundraiser started, I'm assuming, from the executive director's office or Ms. Skull, or I'm not really sure where the fundraiser started or what the parameters of the fundraiser. I'm like everybody else, I just saw the emails going back and forth. So we have this interpretation of this statute into this policy into a certain position, the dissemination of that policy. The next thing I know, there's a fundraiser for a dedicated purpose that I had no input into. And I don't think any of us did as commissioners. So I'm just trying to explain how this all got started.
Actually, I thought it got started because you wanted a refrigerator and asked for a donation and General Counsel's office handled this, I believe. And then that wasn't appropriate to get someone to donate a refrigerator because of ethical issues. So I think that's what was the impetus for the collection.
Well,
that's how I understood it.
I know when you said you, you didn't mean me personally, because no. I know, but I mean, you probably meant Las Vegas, but I know.
I thought it was from you.
No, it was not from me. I know nothing about this and nothing about getting a refrigerator donated in any way whatsoever. I'm just saying this thing, the wheels fell off of this, and this project moved ahead quite rapidly, really without any sort of input or direction. And it's probably, like a lot of things here, it's just miscommunication or no communication. But it led to a lot of confusion. And so a lot of people, including me, went and looked at our energy efficiency policy and tried to understand where this interpretation got extrapolated out of this language, and it was kind of confusing. And then I began to notice about the space heaters, and then I noticed all these other problems that are part of this policy. I just think the policy needs another look. And let me go back and say this again. I'm not trying to take people's space heaters away or their refrigerators or their instant tea makers or whatever they want. I think we ought to make our offices as comfortable as possible. But I really think if we're going to have an energy efficiency policy, we need to be serious about that too and be energy efficient. I'm just asking that we table this and let the executive director do her job and exercise some due diligence and look around and make a recommendation to us as to what's best for the whole agency. I think that makes the most sense to me.
If I may add, I met with Buildings and Grounds, Terry Preston, and the director administrator of that agency here a couple weeks ago, and they had just finished touring an office site in Carson City and directed that agency to clear up each of the cubicles, each of the offices of their individual appliances. That it did not support the state policy. It was a drain on energy and also the power sources within that space. I am merely asking today for some direction for moving purposes. Gotcha. And also for the fundraiser. I think, though, just it was important that I share that information with you because I do know that Buildings and Grounds is very interested in touring our Las Vegas office. It is the first state office, I believe, that's in a LEED certified. So we will be in the spotlight. So I just need direction for letting employees know whether to move their appliance or not. And also I need to know whether to return the funds that were raised specifically for a Las Vegas refrigerator.
I'll give up mine if you'll give up yours.
I have a space heater in my office. I don't use it.
No, I'm not talking about a space heater. This is actually a discussion with the Las Vegas office.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think, you know,
if I could maybe add something here, too, because I do think this is important. Until very recently, I was unaware that the Las Vegas office had not complied with the policy. I was led to believe very recently that there were a total of 5 refrigerators in the Las Vegas office currently, which, you know, seems reasonable. I think there's 30 people in the Las Vegas office. I believe 8 or so of those have remote offices. They're not, you know, they really don't take up office space in the office daily. So that leaves 22 employees in Las Vegas, 5 refrigerators. That's relatively reasonable. When I was in Las Vegas just a week or so ago, I was advised that there are 10 refrigerators in the individual offices in Las Vegas. 10 refrigerators given 22 employees. So roughly half, near almost half of the people have refrigerators. And then to add to that a full-size refrigerator for the break room. And I'm not sure who will use the full-size refrigerator in the break room. It would seem to me that the 10 people that might use it, if they had a need for a refrigerator, they would probably already have one in their office. So I kind of wanted to share that so that we can put this in perspective. In Carson City, I think we have approximately 70 people. And if we have consolidated by division, which I think for the most part we have, then we probably have six or so refrigerators for that amount of people. So, you know, I hope that's helpful. And I do think hopefully we can find a balance here that will work for everyone. And I don't understand if the issue in Las Vegas is that you don't want to keep your water and lean cuisines in a large refrigerator in the break room. And if that's the issue, then let's not get a refrigerator for the break room if it's not going to be used. The refrigerators, as you all know, are plugged in. They're cooled 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, whether we're here or not, and whether or not we have anything in them. In talking with Mark Harris recently, it's my understanding that the little mini refrigerators cost us about $40 a year to run. So by 10 employees in Las Vegas, that's $400 a year. That's what we're paying to run. Now, granted, our lease is all-inclusive. We don't have, you know, individual utility costs that we pay on a monthly basis based on our usage. It's all-inclusive, and our landlord pays those costs. But keep in mind, if there is a pike or a spike in our energy usage over time, those will eventually be factored back into our overall lease cost. A large refrigerator, a full-size energy-efficient refrigerator, I think will cost about $65 a year to maintain, to run.
And Ms. Jackson, I guess this is my thought. Is we are the PUC. We're the ones who are implementing energy conservation programs for everybody else in the state. I think it's probably appropriate, since we're going into a LEED certified building, for us to be, we should be examples. We should be models. So I guess I think that we should probably tell all of everybody in Las Vegas to leave their refrigerators at home, and we should put in a refrigerator in the break room. We have the opportunity to have a break room that the North may not have. And I think that given Ms. Gaw's information about buildings and grounds, the concern this clearly has been, I didn't really thought about in these terms before until the last, you know, day or two, but we approve energy conservation programs for everybody else in the state. And so I think we probably ought to be an example. And so I think everybody in Las Vegas needs to leave their refrigerators at home.
And I'd actually take it a step further, and I completely agree with that. It's what I meant when I said walk the walk. I mean, it really is. We're going to be looked at. You know, we're sitting here in a public meeting talking about this, but I mean, this is the type of thing that that frankly could be embarrassing to us as an entire agency if we're not doing what we're supposed to be doing. I think that we should leave our refrigerators at home. I think that we should leave all of our appliances at home. We don't need really any small appliances in our offices plugged in, because we're going to have a central break room with 30 people. And by the way, I'm not a math major, but if you've got six locations, and it's at least six, but if you've got six in the north with 70 people, that's about 11-1. And if you've got 30 people down here and you've got 10 refrigerators, that's less than that. So from an actual ratio standpoint, there are more refrigerators per person in Carson City than there would be here, even if you did have 10 refrigerators, and I'm not sure that's accurate. But notwithstanding that, what I would suggest is that we have a policy that forbids small appliances in all offices, regardless of location. And small appliances are defined as small appliances are defined. That's everything, folks. That's hair curlers. That's whatever you've got. Electric. Anything that gets plugged in. That's an appliance to warm tea, make coffee, microwave, space heaters, refrigerators. I don't think we should have any of those things in our offices. That's my thought. So, but to give guidance, my thought would be to as of today approve a policy in part and maybe send it back to the executive director for refinement. I think we should have an energy efficiency policy, And I think as far as Las Vegas office is concerned, it should be a real energy efficiency policy and not allow any small appliances in any offices and use our break room for that purpose. With regard to the rest of the policy, and that really pertains to the north, I think this needs more study. I think the executive director ought to go back, review this energy efficiency policy, specifically with an eye toward these space heaters and toward the idea of maybe break rooms as opposed to consolidated areas, and just look at it and bring it back to us. That's, I guess what I'm saying is we can split this, give Ms. Skahl the direction she needs, which I don't think people should be moving their refrigerators or any other appliances over there. I think we should go ahead and buy the refrigerator that the money ostensibly had been raised for and put it in, and that settles that issue. But there's a bigger issue here that we have another office that we need to take a harder look at. And maybe it is that the space heaters are fine and they should be allowed, but I just have, at first brush, a little bit of a problem with extra appliances in any office. So that's my thought.
When I met with Buildings and Grounds, I also discussed with them our individual space heaters. The state's position on space heaters is that they're not allowed. We, however, were advised, because we are not in an energy efficient building, we have single pane windows, the cold that we experience in the inclement weather winter months, that we are justified in having our space heaters. And because of our heating units are old, and when the heating goes out, as I was starting to say a little earlier, I have a space heater in my office. I give it to the employees so they can work in their offices. The problems we've had is temperatures drop below 50 degrees, and we can be sending people to work from home, but how do they conduct their business from home when they need to be available in prepping for cases that come before the commission?
Well, and I think that's well taken, but I think that highlights the problem. I think we really are in two entirely different situations, north and south, with regard to energy efficiency. I mean, we're going into a LEED building. We don't have the same temperatures you guys get in the south, or we don't have the same temperatures you guys get in the north. So maybe we need to have a policy that is sort of specific to each location, because I don't want anybody sitting there freezing in their offices. It's just that doesn't make any sense either.
Tried to type with mittens?
Yeah, that's pretty tough. So, but I'm wondering if, given, I mean, I think this discussion has sort of highlighted that we're really, even though we're the PUC, North and South, we really have different circumstances in which we're working. And so I think maybe we need to identify energy policy that's more specific to each location, perhaps.
Well, I'll add to that. Buildings and Grounds, we are their number one priority in moving us out of the space that we're in 2013. They are committed to finding us an energy efficient space, whether it be solar, LEED, something that supports our mission, and that was expressed.
Yeah, you know, I think in an effort to have one consistent policy for this agency, I'll just do a mea culpa for me. Perhaps I've lost sight of that. I think Commissioner Burtenshaw is really right. We do have to recognize, as I said, I recognize that it gets cold and people need space heaters up north, but maybe we really do need to split this policy or bifurcate it or acknowledge it. And that's what I was suggesting. I mean, I think it's the right thing to do to have a true energy efficiency policy where in the instance of Las Vegas, we have a dedicated break room in an elite LEED certified building, and we should have our appliances in that room. And we should not have them in our individual offices. And I'm more than willing to give up my refrigerator. But, you know, I think that's what we should do down here. And I'm willing to do that. But I also think that we need to be aware that we have as a goal in the north, as is expressed in this policy, to be energy efficient there. You know, there's going to be exceptions. But if you're not careful, the exceptions overtake the rule. And although the state may have a policy of no space heaters, I wonder how many buildings in Carson City are as old as ours, where there's a lot of space heaters in there. In other words, where the exception has now become the rule as opposed to the rule really, really governing. But I think we just need to recognize that and perhaps put that in writing here, is that, you know, that this is our goal, but because of the nature of the building in the north and the inclement weather, that an exception has been made and these will be allowed until further notice. I mean, we need to just to have a blanket policy like this, it's, you know, the next thing we'd have it on, it does get cold down here once in a while. I wouldn't want people bringing their space heaters into our office in Las Vegas, but the way this is written, I guess they could do that. So that's all I'm suggesting is that we approve a policy, and really what probably we ought to do is just defer this and have a comprehensive policy come back, but give Ms. Skull the guidance that she needs as far as the new building is concerned. No appliances of any description should be moved into our offices, and we will have. You know, we've got a break room. There's going to be a microwave in there. If you don't, I've got one I'll donate. I mean, we've got a refrigerator. We've got everything we need. We can put a coffee pot. It's a central location. We really don't need to have any appliances in any of our offices down here. That's my thought, because I think that's to do justice to a LEED certified building, we need to be energy efficient ourselves. And so I think that's the right thing to do. I think I agree with Commissioner Burtenshaw on that. But as far as the rest of the policy, it really needs to be looked at and reviewed, and you know, and maybe there is a need to go to a break room, and maybe that's something you guys want to bring back to us up north. But I think this policy needs to be looked at.
Well, can I ask that the policy be approved so that we have the full support of the commission moving forward with guidance to the executive director to review this and bring it back to another agenda? Is that what I'm hearing, or am I not hearing that?
You know, I guess the problem, and this is sort of, and General Counsel's office may be able to help me here. Under D, appliances, employees are asked to turn off all small appliances when not in use. I mean, I think that probably needs to come out, and or else say, or, you know, when not in use in the break room, you know. I turn off all small. So I think that for Las Vegas anyway, the small appliances, there's a lot of language you hear that's inconsistent that sort of gives with one hand and takes with another and then gives back with the other hand. And so that's my concern is, I mean, maybe we can just, is it possible just to do a vote associated with small refrigerators in Las Vegas? Or, you know, we could add, I guess I'm just trying to figure out how to deal with the inconsistencies here that would suggest that they can actually bring the appliances in. So I guess that's my concern.
Yeah, I guess within what we're noticed for, Ms. Cohen, could we just sort of just take an oral vote here just on how we want to handle energy efficiency policy in Las Vegas and then refer the entire matter of this particular policy back to Ms. Jackson to bring it back to us in a more written format with the understanding that that's what we're doing in Las Vegas. That's what you're...
Yeah, because I think if we approve this policy, we're suddenly, I actually think that if everybody in Las Vegas knows three commissioners have voted that you don't get to bring your refrigerators, they're not going to bring their refrigerators.
You know,
but Ms. Cohen,
because you have, you know, your possibilities under this notice are to accept, modify, or reject. And what you're basically saying is you want to, and this is not even in this policy, this refrigerator issue. I mean, the refrigerator issue is really separate and apart from that. But my suggestion would be to table this, which you seem to want to do, and that the executive director make a decision. But you have made it very clear that there will be no refrigerators at the Las Vegas office. I mean, I don't know that a vote is necessary because all three of you seem, well, I don't know, Commissioner Wagner, I don't, you know, hasn't indicated. But I can't imagine that anyone's going to try to move a refrigerator after this discussion today.
Well,
and that seems to be the concern.
And you know, also just and just to be clear about it, I mean, and that policy has already been disseminated to employees through the executive director's office that no refrigerators will be moved. So we're really not changing anything. We're actually ratifying that orally here, that dissemination of information, that interpretation. So my motion is that we table the policy 1.4, and that we direct the executive director to do some due diligence, which would include but not limited to considering establishing break room or rooms in the north, to actually look at a comprehensive energy efficiency policy as it pertains particularly to Carson City, given the limitations of that building, and that she bring something back to us, which is a comprehensive policy, understanding that we will have to, because of climate and the building issues, that we'll have to treat north and south a little bit differently, and I sure hate to do that, but we do have to do it. And with the understanding that in Las Vegas, because of the LEED certified building, that there will be no small appliances allowed in any of the offices. That's I think that's what the policy should say, and that they'll all be centered in the break room. So that'll be the understanding. But I would like a more comprehensive look. You know, this policy goes back, I think, to 06. I may be wrong on that, but it's a little dated. So maybe we just take a better look at it, refine the language, and be a little more precise. You know, clarity is everything. And rather than having to interpret what this might mean, like Commissioner Burton Shaw said, is, you know, subsection A giveth and subsection B taketh away. Let's just be clear about it. And so maybe just a clear statement of no small appliances in the Las Vegas office, you know, due to its LEED configuration. And then in the north, let's take a good hard look at that and see what do we need, and have some example or some statement with regard to our commitment toward energy efficiency. And if there's going to be an exception to that or a deviation, let's have a good reason and let's state that.
That's very helpful for me we move forward.
Yeah.
And, you know, just as another thought to all of this and this policy, there is a reasonable accommodation that needs to be provided for medical need or breastfeeding mothers, that those requests should go through the personnel officer, which in this case is the commission secretary. So that's something that I would also encourage be put into this policy.
Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea.
Did you make a motion, Chairman? That was a motion, right?
Yeah, it was an awful bad one. It was a long one. So let me see if I can do this. Can you try?
I'm not going to try. All I ask is that any revisions to an energy efficiency policy are consistent with the state conservation plan.
And that's a good point, because I was going to make this earlier. Several of these, in this particular one, there's a, and this is no derogation to our governor, but you know, we says in response to directions set by Governor Gibbons, maybe we should not mention particular names in these policies, because that's going to change, you know. And I'm just making that as a suggestion, because we ought to make our I'm thinking we should make our policy so that we don't have to change them from time to time. Over in transportation, when I first got there, the policies actually named the chairman by name. So when a new chairman came in, we had to change all the policies. So it's sort of analogous to that. Maybe make them a little more innocuous in that it's just a policy. And like Commissioner Wagner says, it is in concert and in furtherance of the state energy and conservation program. We can just simply say that is sort of as a preamble, make them more generic. I like that. So my motion, I guess my motion is this matter be tabled, and that policy 1.4 not be voted on today, be deferred and be tabled, and with the direction that I've expressed, and perhaps there's other direction that you heard from the other commissioners, to bring back to us a more comprehensive policy, with the understanding that the move to the Las Vegas office will be under the terms that we've discussed, and that'll be referenced in the policy. I think so.
Concur.
Okay. Wow. All right.
In light of the fact that I'm going to have to leave shortly, there's one section I want to address is ARA travel, and I thought maybe we could just pull out the ones that we want to discuss and then vote on the other ones in bulk. Is that okay, Jan?
Yes.
Okay.
Can I make one real quick suggestion too? Where is it? Page 78. This is just I think a typo thing. Policy 5.2, just to, if they're in bulk, that this change be made. The computers network and systems to be used for the legislative business purposes of the Public Utilities Commission, not Secretary of State's office.
Thank you.
So we've got that in two places?
Yeah, it's in two places, right.
Yeah.
And I would just, you know, add that clarification.
Okay, so the one item that I want to take out is the travel, and that's 3.1. Otherwise, I don't have anything else I want to bring out.
Why don't you go ahead? You want to?
Yeah. As you all know, we have a grant from the Department of Energy that provides for two positions at the commission, as well as a lot of funding for travel and training. What some of you may not know is that I'm the one who does our progress reports and our quarterly reporting, except for the financial reporting, which is done through fiscal. I had asked the executive director to ask employees to do some kind of summary and provide written materials, because that's consistent with, one, what we stated in our grant proposal, but two, it's my way of checking to make sure people attended, where they attended, what the topic was in the event we're audited by Department of Energy. It has been brought to my attention that this has become so onerous and so difficult that people are not traveling because of it. And while I find that virtually absurd, I want people to travel. I went to a lot of work to get nearly $1 million for this agency for training, which includes travel, to bring us up to speed on a number of issues that I think we just don't get to because we have so many other cases and stuff going on. So what I'm recommending is that we, out of, and this is section C under training, sub 2, it's on page 32, just strike that section, and I will work with fiscal to figure out who's traveled and for what reasons. And also be more engaged on the front end to make sure that some of the travel is actually RO-related. So I'll just strike, I think that's where, I think we just strike the RO-related training. Is that?
I think what you're looking at is on page 32, section
right.
2, sub A. It's
correct.
About halfway through the paragraph. It says employees attending ERA-funded training are required to, and I think you want to strike the remainder of that paragraph.
Actually, the whole thing doesn't make sense if we're not going to make employees be accountable for their travel. So the accountability, I guess, will just come from their travel justification. So that's why I don't see where this is even relevant at this point. Do you see what I'm saying? Yeah,
all of
Jackson,
section
does that
two.
Make sense?
All of section two
yeah.
will be omitted. Okay.
Okay. And do you guys have any questions on that?
No.
No.
Two real quick matters. Under policy 3.1 agency travel, I just want to suggest maybe we add something which is what we're doing. Under subsection 1, it talks about commission hearings, about presiding officers making a determination for travel and setting dates certain. And then under subsection 2, it says other commission proceedings, and that's where it says there that they should be held by video conferencing. And, of course, a lot of our hearings are video conference, too. So I would just suggest that under subsection 1, it would read, the location of the hearing will be determined by the presiding officer. Presiding officer shall minimize the need for travel by considering the number of employees who would need to travel, comma, and insert the following, and the appearance of witnesses via video conferencing, period. And that just really recites what we really do anyway, and it just that's one another consideration we'd have. So I'd make that suggestion that we just put that in there. Any objection or questions on that? And we'll leave section 2A just like it is, but just acknowledge under section 1 that we also consider use of video conferencing for witnesses in full hearings. Okay. And the other one, I just want to bring this up under emergency agenda meetings 1.7, and I mentioned this to Ms. Cohen earlier today, and you know, as we have this transmutation because of AB 510, which I think you know I supported and still support, you know, it really is the commission, And this policy sort of goes back to when the chair was the executive authority in setting emergency agendas. My suggestion would be maybe where it says chair that we put a commissioner or a requesting commissioner. It seems kind of silly to me that if Commissioner Wagner needs an emergency agenda, that she would somehow contact me to do that. And I guess it sets up a scenario, maybe we've had some bad experiences in our past, where what if the chairman declined to do that? So I think, you know, we're all equal up here. I say that we just have a commissioner contact general counsel and the assistant commission secretary and have it go forth as such. I mean, what do you think about that?
You lost me there for a second. We moved from travel over.
I did.
I have no objection on the emergency agenda issue. That makes sense.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Okay. Then I would just suggest that, like on under A2, where it says commission chairman, how about it says the scheduling commissioner will notify the assistant commission secretary and general counsel. And then the next place it appears is under 4, the second to last sentence, it says, where it says the chairman may add, a commissioner may add the emergency item to the agenda. And then under 5, where it says the assistant commissioner will notify the chairman, the assistant commissioner will notify the requesting commissioner. And, you know, you're going to have that filter with the general counsel's office anyway.
So, say requesting or scheduling commissioner?
Either one. What do you think, scheduling?
Well, I think if we're going to use them both places.
Okay, let's go scheduling. So it's the same. Okay. And those were my only comments. And with those two changes and your change, and do you have any changes on the rest of it, then perhaps we can vote on the remainder of these policies. So with my two changes and Commissioner Wagner's changes, then I move that we accept the remainder of the policies that are presented to us today.
Second.
Concur.
All right. And I think
that's... Oh, would you, and that includes policy 5.2, which would be the change of the, I don't know if you mentioned the change the Secretary of State.
Yeah,
that's the only one.
Yeah, and let me just amend the motion. What I said before, plus the changes to policy 5.2.
Okay.
Second.
Concur. All right, and that may be the end of our. Yeah. Do we have any public comment or anything that I've omitted or anything anybody wants to add? Okay. Thank you. Then we're adjourned.
Those UC? Yeah.
Well, be brilliant.
I actually made a PowerPoint.
Did you really?